issue for me is you mentioned that football's an avenue out for so many people because they don't have these mentors. They don't have people telling them to study up. They don't have people helping them in school. Well, that's the problem. Let's help them with the schools.
I'm going straight to the top. Yo, 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 what's going on, everybody? Mike here, Sports and the Real podcast, coming at you once again. As always, I appreciate everybody tuning in, listening, watching YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're watching and listening. Thanks for spending a couple hours with me. A couple minutes, not hours. Don't forget to like and subscribe and share. Family and friends, get on board. Also, check out the website, sportsandthereal.tv. If you haven't gone out there yet, go out. Check it out. I try to add you stuff as best as I can. But check it out. Bookmark it. And as I grow, you'll wish you bookmarked it. On a serious note, I'm happy to have a special guest with me today. So I talk a lot about varying, you know, what I do and talk about on this podcast. We talk football. We talk basketball mainly. Other sports as big news comes up. I told you guys I want to get into other topics, more important topics as sports fans that matter to us as humans. But today I think we have a bit of a different conversation, right, than what we're used to. So I have with me as a guest an ER doctor, Jeff Sankoff, who's an ER doctor, but also a triathlete, and we'll get into that in a bit. 20 years of experience as a triathlete, actually. He's completed more than 80 7.3 distance races, including 6 world championships, 8 Ironman races. And those things take about, for those of you guys who aren't familiar with triathlon, which I wasn't until I met Jeff, those things average finishes like 13 hours. And after like 15, 16 hours or something like that, they'll kick you off the course. including 2 Ironman championships. Like, if you're not in shape, you can't just say, hey, I know how to ride my bike, let me go be a triathlete, or I know how to swim. 2 world championships. And since 2018, he's produced the TriDoc podcast and is a coach with Life Sport Coaching. So I think we'll have an interesting conversation here, and I think you guys should, listen up here and hang around for a while. I think it'll be great. So, Jeff, welcome to the show, man. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Cool. So let's get into it. In the intro, I talked about you being a triathlete. How'd you get into triathlon? And first of all, how do you make time to even train for this stuff? And you're an ER doctor, and I complain all the time I don't have time, but I'm not a doctor. How have you made time to train and sustain it for 20 plus years as a triathlete?
Well, that's 2 big questions with 2 long answers. So I'll take the first one, which is how did I get into the multi-sport thing in the first place? When I finished up my training back in 2001, I guess it was when I was finishing, I was facing a new life, really. I was finishing up this intensive residency and fellowship training that I had been doing for many years. And now all of a sudden I realized, wow, I'm going to have a lot of time. And up until that point, I had spent all of my time playing hockey. And ice hockey was my passion. I grew up in Montreal, after all, you know, home of the Canadiens and real ice hockey hotbed. So I had played hockey ever since I was a kid. And I was still trying to play there in my early 30s. Wanting very much to keep up with the 18-year-olds I was playing with. But over the course of my training as an emergency physician, I had not been eating well, not been taking care of myself. And by the time I finished, I was grossly overweight. I weighed 215 pounds. I was very much out of shape. And I faced this kind of moment where I like to call it my Andy Dufresne moment, if you're familiar with the movie The Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
Where Andy says to Red at one point, he's like, I either have to get busy living or get busy dying. And that's kind of how I felt, because I had a family history of heart disease, and I felt like I was on a one-way track to the not the place I want it to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know.
So I decided to get in shape. I decided to start eating better. I started exercising more regularly. And over the course of 3 or 4 months, I started to see some changes. I went from 215 down to about 190-ish. That took several months, but I got there eventually. And one of my coworkers in my new job noticed that I was losing weight. And she said to me at this welcome dinner we had for new physicians, she said, so what have you been doing to lose weight? I've really noticed a change. And I told her, I said, well, you know, I've been eating better. I've been doing a lot of weightlifting, riding my bike a little bit, doing some running. And she said, oh, you really need to do a triathlon. And I
just
I
out of
said,
the blue, like, yo, let's do it.
Well, she was a triathlete herself. She was quite accomplished. Yeah. And so she was trying to get me into it. And I said, oh, yeah, no, I can't do that. Number one, I don't know how to swim, like quite literally did not know how to swim. And number two, the only triathlon I knew of was the race I saw on TV once a year that came from Hawaii, which was the Hawaii Ironman. That was the only triathlon I'd ever heard of. And over the course of dinner, she explained to me that triathlon was much more than that. There are races of all kinds of different distances. They happen all over the world. And there were many local to where I was living at the time in Montreal. And she said, oh, you can learn to swim. Swimming is not that difficult. She was very wrong about that. But over the course of dinner, she got me really interested in trying this. And I went home. And my wife, who had not been at the dinner because she'd been working, and she was sitting there watching some TV, and I walked in and I said, you know, I think I'm going to do a triathlon. And her response was to laugh, which, you know, understandable. Yeah, it's understandable. But I took that as like the gauntlet was thrown, and I said, well, that's it. Before I was thinking about it, now I'm going to do it. And so I hired somebody. I hired somebody to teach me how to swim. I spent like a year really learning how to be able to swim the distance I needed to. I signed up for a few races, and 20 something years later, here I am.
Wow. So basically your wife is the reason why you're in great shape today. Cause
well, and she sort of like has a plus minus on the whole thing because she knows how it's been a real time suck, and I'm very passionate about it, but at the same time, it's been a net positive for
us. How do you stay in shape then? Right, you talk about the times. Like, how do you stay in shape for this stuff? Like, I play basketball once a week. I know I couldn't play in the NBA playing once a week. You have to train, like, all the time to be able to compete in these races.
Yeah, everybody who is in triathlon comes at it from a different sort of place. I have the good fortune to work in a job that is shift work. So my shifts rotate around. I don't work every day. And when I don't work, I'll do more training. When I have a shift, I have to be able to do a shorter amount of training, but I'm able to work it around my shifts. And I work overnights, I work weekends. So what ends up happening is that I do end up with days where I don't have shifts, and it's easier for me to get things done in terms of training. The issue was, when I was sort of getting into the sport and getting very passionate about it, we had younger kids, and I didn't do a great job of finding a good balance between the real important stuff, family and my work responsibilities, and the training, which I so desperately wanted to do. And so it took me a while to kind of find that balance. And now I'm at a point where my kids are much older. My kids are in high school. They're much more self-sufficient. And I have been able to figure out how to be very efficient in my own training and be able to get things done so that I'm able to keep all the balls in the air, because I do have a lot of balls in the air, no question.
Yeah, that's one of the challenges. And I'm trying to figure it out myself, as I have young kids, trying to stay in shape during the week. And I have a gym here that I don't use as often as I want to. I say I play basketball once a week. I would like to play basketball more often, but right now I only have time to play once a week, and my kids have sports that they're into now, and it's a lot. I'm like, I'm trying to learn myself, like, how did you end up, you know, figuring out like all these things happening? Like I said, you're a doctor. I'm not. My work is not shift work, so I have, you know, I'm working till whenever, really, 5 days a week at least. How did you end up making it work? And what advice would you give to, you know, men, women who are struggling to do the same, like struggling to stay in shape and do what they're passionate about because they're trying to be good fathers, dads, and husbands and all that, managing a career and all that?
So I'd say a couple of things to that. Number one, it's why I think I'm really effective as a coach, because I'm able to work with people who come to me and have all those different responsibilities, and yet they have goals that they want to accomplish. And I'm able to help them kind of fit or design a training plan that fits into their life. Because I think one of the mistakes I made early on is I tried to make my life fit my training. And that's where you get into trouble. You can never make, you know, you end up sacrificing bits and pieces from your life. You're not doing the things that you need to be doing well in your life. And then you never end up doing your training all that well either. And it took me a little while to realize what you need to do is make your training fit your life. And everybody's life is different. And yet there is always a way to find some amount of time to get training done. It's just a matter of, are you willing to make some of the sacrifices? So for me, I used to have a few things that I really enjoyed doing. I used to love to read. I used to read novels and nonfiction all the time. I don't do that nearly as much anymore. I don't do it. I only do that when I have long stretches of like vacation or times when I'm not doing things. I used to watch things on television. I don't watch TV. We don't even subscribe to cable because I just don't watch TV anymore, because that was something that I gave up.
So you don't watch any games?
No, nothing.
Well, dang.
Just imagine how much time you'd have, right? I mean, if
entertainment then?
I'm
training.
Yeah. I mean, I'm training anywhere from 12 to 16 hours a week on top of my other responsibilities. So that's like 2 hours a day. So not everybody does that though. A lot of people will train 10 hours a week, and 10 hours a week turns into generally 1 hour a day during the week. And then a couple hours a day on the weekends. And almost everybody can do that.
Wow. What kind of training does a triathlete do? Are you just like riding your bike all over the city?
So nowadays, there are a lot of options so that you don't have to actually go out. And that's one of the ways that it really helps to be very efficient with your training. So I have a whole setup in my basement where my bicycle is mounted on this electronic trainer. Oh. It's connected to a computer. So my training program is in the computer, and the computer controls the trainer that basically makes it easier or harder for me to pedal. So everything is automated. And if I have a hour and a half or a 2 hour bike that I need to do, I get changed into my clothes. I fill up my water bottles. I go to the basement. I get on my bike. I bang out that workout. I get off the bike, go take my shower, and I'm done. And the whole thing only adds, 10 minutes on each end. So if the workout's an hour and a half, I'm done after an hour and 55 minutes.
But you don't have a pool in your house, so what about swimming?
I don't have a pool, so swimming is the biggest issue. Running is easy, because running is just a matter of putting on your shoes, walking out the door, and going for a run.
Yeah.
That's super easy. But swimming is the one that takes the most time, because I've got to drive to the pool, got to swim, got to get changed, and that is the one that takes the most time, no question.
All right. Cool. If you want to be a triathlete, I'm always interested in new things. I don't know if triathlon's my thing, but I like to learn about stuff like that, because really I've stuck to the mainstream sports, basketball, football. By the way, you said you were a hockey player. So I had a hot take when I used to watch hockey back in the day. I had a hot take on hockey. You want to hear it?
Sure.
So I made a statement once that I think Mark Messier is a better hockey player than Wayne Gretzky. What do you think about that?
So hard to compare guys who are very different, but I would say that that's probably not the case. Wayne Gretzky is one of the greatest players of all time. Mark Messier,
but
definitely a great player.
Mark Messier won without Wayne Gretzky. Wayne Gretzky couldn't win without Mark Messier.
I
No.
You know, Mark ended up on a team where he was surrounded by other talent. Wayne Gretzky never ended up on another team. I mean, he did get back to the Stanley Cup.
He did.
But they were beaten by my Canadians, which Correct. I'm happy about. And he just never was surrounded by the kind of talent that Mark was. And Mark won late in his career where he didn't contribute as much with his hockey talent. He contributed more with his leadership quality.
He was a leader. That's correct. Yeah.
And Wayne Gretzky, I mean, you know, when you compare the greats, Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, I mean, the greats of our time, Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, you've got today, Sidney Crosby. I mean, there's some just phenomenal hockey players out there. Just skills alone, they are more individually skilled than Mark. And listen, no disrespect to Mark Messier, who's one of the greats also.
So your goat is Gretzky, not Lemieux, because I know some people have Lemieux over Gretzky. Like, you think Gretzky's, because of his stats, he's just all-time. I was on Twitter. I don't know if you're on Twitter. I was on Twitter recently, and somebody out of nowhere said Crosby was, like, better than Gretzky. And I think, like, that's such a recency bias. That's like people saying, like, well, LeBron James is not better than Michael Jordan, like, it's like what they've seen the latest is like because they put up maybe more points in a wide open game, like they're like, oh, this guy's got to be better.
Yeah, that's a recency bias. And I mean, how long is it going to be before people are saying Connor Bedard is better than Sidney Crosby?
Yeah.
So I think you have to give it some time before you can say something like that about Sidney. Listen, Sidney Crosby, again, one of the greats. But in my mind, Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux were head and shoulders above everybody else. Everybody else is really needs to be compared to them. They were different players, though, right? Because Gretzky was a finesse. He was a small guy. He depended on his speed and his maneuverability. I mean, when you watch some highlights of Wayne Gretzky, it's kind of like watching some of these NBA players, the stuff that they could do with stopping on a dime and the puck handling. Whereas Lemieux had just an incredible touch, but he was a really big player, and he could fend off people. He could do things with strength that Gretzky never could. So they were slightly different kinds of players. It's hard again to compare them. I always felt personally, seeing them both at the same time, I thought Gretzky was the better player. But I don't begrudge anybody who would think Lemieux was better.
Yeah, I just remember watching when I used to watch hockey. This was like mid 90s. I think that's one of the things that TV has changed in sports watching is like now, and I've made the argument on this podcast that now if you want to just watch football, you can watch football year round because it's on YouTube. There is different podcasts breaking down football all year. Like when I was growing up, like I had to go from football to basketball to hockey to baseball. Like I had to watch everything. Or else I wasn't watching TV because I didn't really watch like other shows and things like that, right? I was really like a sports watcher. So I watched quite a bit of hockey growing up. Not so much anymore, but I feel like I missed those days because I know like a game 7 in hockey is probably like the wildest thing you ever want to see. But I just remember those Lemieux and Jaromir Jagr, you know, like I remember these names and Eric Lindros, right? Like I don't feel like hockey's crossover. Hockey was never a crossover, but I feel like it was more crossover back then. But again, because of people able to just focus on one sport nowadays, like it's impossible for hockey to gain the attention that it used to, you know, back in the day, I feel like.
Hockey remains very popular in the markets where teams exist, but outside of those markets, it still continues to be a very niche kind of sport. And often, even within those areas where there's a team, they struggle. Like, I think the Arizona team moved to Utah this year? I mean,
oh, really?
That's crazy. Yeah, that's a crazy move. I mean, the team was not doing well in Arizona, and now they're moving to another kind of desert town that doesn't really have a big hockey history and doesn't have a big population, and they're hoping for better results, and I don't know if they're going to get it. We'll see. Utah does have a history of supporting sports teams, so they might end up being a good fit, but we'll see. But there's no question, hockey has just struggled for years to break out of its markets. And I think that's too bad, because hockey really is, I think, one of the more entertaining sports. And I think part of the fault for hockey to not gain more popularity is on the NHL, because the NHL continues to resist making changes that would make the game more accessible and more interesting to people. Like, we've seen when the NHL players go to the Olympics and participate in the Olympic hockey games, the hockey games are wildly entertaining. And a big part of that is because the rinks are bigger. But the NHL refuses to adopt those larger sized rinks because it would cost them seats. They'd have to have less seats if they had larger rinks, and therefore, it's all down to money. So even though that they would probably come out ahead because the game would become more popular and they'd get better ratings and everything else, no, they're too short-sighted. They don't want to give up any revenue, and so they keep things the way they are.
Yeah. Now, the bigger rinks, I'm assuming that's for just more spacing, more offense. Is that what that is?
It's just the way the rules are. The International Ice Hockey Federation has a larger rink than does the NHL, and it's significantly larger. I don't know the measurements myself, but if you ever watch an international game, you could really see how much bigger the rink is. And what that does is it leads to more open space for these skill players. And whereas the NHL, with its small rink, it kind of encourages the whole dump and chase offense. It encourages teams to take a defensive posture, and you'll often get these very boring teams that do very well in the NHL because they can have this kind of lockdown defense. Yeah. That goes away when you have a much bigger ice surface. With a bigger ice surface, there's so much room. It's really hard with five guys to do a lockdown defense, and so that doesn't tend to happen. It's also very hard to be successful with dump and chase. And so that's why for a long time we used to see the teams coming out of Finland, Sweden, Russia, the Czech Republic, when they were the Czech Republic, we used to see those teams do very, very well in the international tournaments because they were used to playing on the big ice surface. They knew that they didn't have to spend so much time dealing with the physicality of hockey and instead could play skill. And they did. They played beautifully.
Now, the NBA has changed the rules for more offense. The NFL has changed the rules for more offense. Baseball tries to change the rules for more offense. Even though baseball is analytics driven, it's like home run or bust nowadays. Hockey sounds to me like could stand to, you know, gain more offense, but it doesn't want to. So,
well, they've tweaked it, right? They've done a couple of things. They removed the center line. So two line, there used to be a rule called the two line pass that no longer is in effect. So now you get these long breakout passes, which was one thing that they tried to do to take away this clogging up the neutral zone defense that teams did. And then the other thing that they did is they've put restrictions on the goaltender's equipment to try and make the goalie's equipment smaller so that there was more.
Oh, really?
more ability for shooters to get the puck past the goaltenders on their gigantic pads.
What?
And that has had an effect. Both of those things have. But the bigger effect has come just from better players. We've seen more skilled players coming into the game, and that has resulted in more entertaining games. But I think it would be still even more entertaining if they had a larger ice surface.
Yeah.
But that's just my two cents.
Yeah. No, I like talking hockey a little bit. I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm a hockey historian, but I remember the days, and I miss the days, honestly, of watching hockey. Now I just catch, you know, the game sevens of the playoffs and things like that. So let me ask you this, triathlon, before we move off that topic. So when I was doing research for the podcast, I remember that they had the issues in Paris with the water, the Seine River and all that. I don't know if you paid attention to that. Like, dude, it was dirty. They couldn't practice for a couple of days. Like, would you have, no, you're a doctor, would you have swam in that? Like, what's the nastiest body of water you swim in?
So the swim in triathlon is becoming more and more problematic. And the reason for that is related to climate change, essentially. As water bodies have been heating up, they're more prone to bacterial and algal overgrowth. And that makes the water not great to swim in, not safe to swim in. And so we see all kinds of medical papers coming out, and I've reviewed this on my podcast where I've talked about, can swimming make you sick? And indeed it can. If you swim in a area that is surrounded by farmland and you have an event that takes place within 24 to 48 hours of a heavy rainfall, the coliform count in that body of water is going to be significantly elevated just because of runoff off of the farmland. So we see repeatedly episodes of triathlons or other kinds of swimming events that take place in rivers or lakes or reservoirs after a rainfall, and large numbers of participants get sick. The issues with the Seine are related to the fact that Paris is just an old city and never really had a good sewage system. They just built their city on top of this hundreds-year-old sewage system and never really fixed it. And they tried to fix it this year, but they also faced the issue with runoff. Anytime that there was a rainfall, they had all kinds of problems. And although the water was felt to be clean, and I'm using air quotes here, the issue was is that the standards in Europe are not the same as the standards in North America. So the water would have actually failed quality tests in North America, but it passed the quality tests as they were set up in Europe. Now,
well, hold on a second. So Europe is usually the opposite of America when it comes to health.
So I know. Yeah.
What is that about?
I just the way it is. I don't know. They just, I heard that on the broadcast of the race. They were talking about how the coliform threshold in Europe was something like three or five times higher than it is in North America. And so the race would not have been allowed to go ahead in North America, but it was allowed to go ahead in Europe. So to answer the question of whether or not I would have swum, I mean, I wouldn't have, but I wasn't there representing my country going for a gold medal and all that entails. And I know, talking to a friend of mine who, Matt Sharp is a friend of mine. He was a Canadian Olympian in Tokyo, and his wife is Kirsten Casper. She represented the United States this year. And I was chatting with him in the lead up to the event. And she was not giving it a thought. If the race was going to be on, she was going to go, and she did.
Wow. Yeah, see, that we talked about this when we met the other day. Like, that's a money thing, I feel like, then. If they're allowing people to just swim in dirty water, knowing what I know about Europe always being more careful when it comes to health in the United States, like, it's like the Olympics are here. Like, you guys are going to swim no matter what, like. You're just going
to
do it.
I mean, there's something to that. And there's also something to the fact that the athletes would have pushed very hard for it as well, because that's what they'd been working for 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, transitioning to talk about making money and money being online. So the NFL, I've talked about this on the podcast for my listeners. I did a whole episode on the NFL and CTE, the impacts, and I did that episode after, I forget who it was, but there's been a couple athletes, suicides in the past, but there was a couple athletes last year who were pretty much acting out, and I was like, man, there's gotta be like pre-CTE and things like that. So I did a whole thing on the NFL and kids not playing football as much anymore, and the NFL needed to change the rules even more than they have, and things like that. And then this year, this Super Bowl, I don't know if you watched the Super Bowl. You don't watch TV, so you probably don't know.
Well, I don't watch football.
Yeah, that's right. So the NFL had a commercial. The NFL is trying to expand globally, no doubt about it. They play in Europe all the time, like 5-6 games a year now. They were in Brazil. They kicked off the season in Brazil this year, like things like that. But the NFL had a commercial. Essentially, it was about kids in Africa trying to, you could play in the NFL too. And it got me to thinking about my recording, and I was like, the NFL wanting to expand, is it only possible that the NFL can expand to people, minorities, to people, lower income folks, lower income countries? Because the NFL has never played a game in Africa. they all, you know, they're always playing in Europe and somewhere else. But it seems like they're trying to go globally and target, you know, those of lower income levels. And I'm like, I don't know. And when we talked about it, you were like, you don't think the NFL really has a space to grow, even with lower income kids. But I did want to get your thoughts and talk about it here, since you're an expert at this. You've seen the injuries in the ER, right, from football. Your thoughts, you know, on the NFL, should we be playing it? Can the NFL expand? How can the NFL expand? Does it need to go to flag football? And, you know, some of the impacts to football, because I think, like, when I talk about it, right, I'm just a guy, you know, I'm watching the effects of it, but you see it, right? You've probably seen some nasty stuff, I'm sure, in the ER. So what are your thoughts on that, right? Football, the NFL growing, impact of injuries on the body and things like that.
Well, we just saw also Brett Favre, right? He just came out and said he has early onset Parkinson's.
Yeah, Parkinson's.
Yeah, which is also related to repeated head injuries.
Is it?
Well, that's what Muhammad Ali had.
Good point. Good point. Taking blows to the head.
Yep. It's called pugilistic Parkinson's and pugilistic dementia is what it's called. So there you go. Look, like I said to you the other day, I took my family to Europe and we went to Rome and we were in the Colosseum there. And you're standing in this amazing structure that's 2,000 years old, probably more, 2,500 years old. And you're just sort of visualizing ancient Rome, and they're telling you about what took place in these incredible stadiums. And you are imagining the people of Rome filing into this place. I mean, this place held tens of thousands of people, very, very similar to the kinds of stadiums we see today being used for professional sports. And people would file in and they would take their seats and they had concessions, and it was a family kind of event, although I think at the time it was only men who went, so it wasn't really family. But anyways, people would be there in the tens of thousands, and they would be there for one reason, and it was to watch a spectacle of gladiators who would fight to the death and who would often fight against wild animals like tigers. And it was a brutal, awful spectacle. These were men who had no choice in the matter. They were there and told, you fight to the death or we kill you. Right. So they really had no option. And I used to, you know, we talked about it as a family, and I asked my son and my daughter, I said, well, do you think if you had been here at that time that you would have had the ability to separate yourself from the crowd and say, this is not acceptable. We don't want to participate in seeing this and participate in enabling this. And it's hard. It's really hard to answer that question, because it's easy for us now to judge with today's morals, but to try and put yourself into that time period and time frame and that society is something you just can't do. It's a theoretical exercise. But I decided pretty soon after that I didn't want to be in that crowd, and that crowd really does exist today. It exists in the form of all of the people watching the young men who are putting themselves on the football field every weekend and putting their bodies and their brains basically in peril for the sake of the viewing public, who cheers on the biggest hits, who cheers on the violence of the game. And I had long been a football fan. I had watched it my whole life. I had my favorite team. I participated in football pools with friends. So it's not like I was turning away from something that I only had a casual interest in. This was something that I had always been very passionate about. And I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to participate in this anymore, because I could not in good conscience watch young men, predominantly minority young men from inner city neighborhoods, who were given the false promise that this was their only way out and this was the only way that they were going to find success, was to put their bodies on the line. And I just didn't want to be a part of that.
Yeah, well, you say that, and people sell drugs, right? You talk about minorities, but people sell drugs because they don't feel like there's a way out. Playing football, as it turns out, for a lot of people, is a way out. Because if you take away football, not to, you know, say that they couldn't do anything else, but there is the appearance that there is no other way out, right? They're from terrible situations. These guys, a lot of them, you know, they don't have anybody, you know, guiding them in school, helping them get the right grades, so they're able to get into college on a football scholarship. Nobody's telling them, you know, to study up. Somebody's probably doing the work for them, or, you know, they're whatever it is, right? Like, I went to Florida State. And the athletes I had classes with a lot of times barely, if ever, came to class. So they don't have anyone guiding them to anything else outside of using their athleticism. They're big, strong, you know, fast guys to do football, to play football. So if you took football away, and that's been where I am, right, in this conversation, as much as I want these guys, you know, protect themselves, their brain, and all of these things, I'm like, man, the NFL has to change. The NFL needs to go to flag football as soon as possible because they're on the way there, right, as they make the game softer. But I'm like, that is an avenue for a lot of black men to get out of the situation that they're in. So then if you take that out, then what, right? Kind of like boxing was, boxing used to be. And I guess now the MMA is as well. I don't know. The MMA to me is even more like gladiators in football, if you ask me, because that, I don't see the point of MMA, but that's kind of right. Where I'm at. I'm torn with it. So I see it as play football, potentially get out of the situation you're in. But the truth is, and I have a neighbor who played at the University of Alabama. When I first met him, I asked him, you know, we were talking, he said, yeah, I play football. I was like, man, I want my kids, you know, put my kids in football, you know, basketball. He was like, don't put them in football. He said, put them in basketball, baseball, because he said for 99.9% of people who play football, the risk is just not worth it. But for a lot of folks, for us, we're fortunate that my kids are going to have different options. But a lot of folks, they don't see those alternatives, man. It's like, if I don't play football, we're stuck here. So what do I do?
So I think you answered your own question a couple of times. Number one, you said boxing used to be that avenue. It's not anymore, right? Boxing is not nearly as popular. Boxing doesn't bring in as many youth as it used to. And so those youth have turned to somewhere else, and many of them have turned to football. I think that points out the fact that with time, things can change. And I'm not saying that you have to take football away right now. I don't think you could. I don't think you will. I'm just saying I'm not going to be party to it. The issue for me is you mentioned that football's an avenue out for so many people because they don't have these mentors. They don't have people telling them to study up. They don't have people helping them in school. Well, that's the problem. Let's help them with the schools. Invest in our communities. I'm a pie in the sky, you know, the sky, you know, the rainbow technicolor kind of guy. But the reality is I refuse to believe that we need to keep football because we're not going to do the bigger, better thing of actually addressing the inequities and actually addressing the reason why these kids have to go to football.
Yeah, okay, good, fair point. But then when me and you were talking, you mentioned hockey and the injuries that come with hockey. I don't know if the hockey injuries are as severe as football and long lasting with the brain and all that, but I don't suspect that hockey kids come from, you know, poorer backgrounds and environments. So what do you say to that then?
Well, my kids didn't play. I played hockey. My kids didn't, because I was concerned. I think that there is the risk of those injuries. There don't seem to be as pronounced as in football because hockey has evolved much more quickly than football has. So, for example, when I played hockey, we played without contact until you were 13, and then they introduced contact, and it was kind of a free-for-all. Now they don't play with contact until they're, I think, 16 or 17. So they really let the kids grow a lot older. They let them refine their skill set much more before they actually introduce contact in hockey. So that, to me, is a big positive. That doesn't mean there's not injuries occurring, because hockey is a physical game, and hockey does, I mean, listen, you're wearing a lot of equipment for a reason.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, listen, a lot of these contact sports are going to have risks, but we know that football, soccer, and rugby are way above everything else. Now, soccer is much better since they have changed the rules about heading the ball. So minor soccer, they're not allowed to head the ball anymore until they get much older, and that has reduced the injury risk of soccer. So I kind of remove soccer from that list. Rugby and football are, they are in their own category in terms of the brain injury risk and just the overall injury risk compared to other sports.
Now, you work in the ER. Have you seen, like, you get a lot of people, kids coming in, like, football injuries?
Every fall.
And what do you tell a parent, right? So I'm putting myself, right, as if I was to put my kids in football, we won't, now that I know better. But my kid gets hurt like that. If I was a football player, I'm like, man, how do they get back out on the field, right? Can you fix this torn ACL, this broken limb that's hanging off? Like, what do you tell parents in this situation, right? Like, their kids come in, they're bruised up, but they're trying to get back in the game.
Well, there's a couple of things that are involved here. Number one, there's the kid themselves, right? The kid is part of a team. They want desperately to continue doing something they enjoy. They feel they're going to let their team down. They feel they're going to let their parents down. They feel like this is something that is so important to them, they don't want to miss it. And then there's the parents who frequently, not always, but I frequently will see parents who are either living vicariously through their kids or have this kind of mistaken belief that their kid's sport is more important than anything else because their kid's sport is somehow their ticket to success.
Yes,
and we know that's just not the case most of the time. Just last week, I had a kid come in from a football game, and it happens every week. The games start here Thursday. We see kids get injured in practice, but most of the time it's games. So starting on Thursday, we start to see kids rolling in by ambulance, usually one per shift. And this kid came in. He'd been taken down in a hard tackle, and he couldn't get up because something happened with his back. And so they put him on a backboard, put him on a stretcher, ambulance, picked him up, took him off the field, brought him to the hospital. Dad and mom are there. And fortunately, it ended up that it was nothing important. The kid was fine. All the x-rays were negative. He ended up being able to walk out, and it was all good. But from the moment he got there, all he could ask about was, am I going to be all right to go back to my next game? And the parents were completely nonplussed.
I'm assuming this is high school.
High school, yeah. And the kids were completely the parents were completely nonplussed. They had no, they didn't seem concerned. They didn't seem, I mean, if it was my kid who'd had some near potential paralytic injury, that would be it. It would not be playing football anymore. I'm sorry, son. I know you love this sport, but we're going to find something else. But these parents were like, no, they were all in. He was going back to play because that's what he does. And I'm like, hey, it's your kid.
What do you think? So the NFL is taking some measures, right? They have different helmets now. They have this guardian cap. I don't know if you've looked into this stuff. Like, does that stuff work?
I don't know enough about it. I mean, I really don't. That's not my thing. I've seen the helmets, the big sort of plush kind of overlying whatever it is. I mean, listen, more protection is probably going to be better. But the big issue with football is not necessarily the force with which you're hit, but the force with which your head then rebounds and moves. It's bouncing off the turf and all of that other stuff, because it's the rotational force and how your brain gets kind of scrambled within the skull. So there's a lot to it. And I don't think there's any amount of padding or helmets that you can put on a person when a 300-pound man is hitting you and knocking you the other way and hitting you into the ground. I mean, this is like, It's bad.
Do you think there's anything they can do? So football is football. You said the headgear doesn't change anything. Is there anything they could do? Like, would they have to totally change the game, like, for football to not be as risky as it is and negatively impactful on your health as it is?
Yes. It's interesting. You compare rugby to football. Rugby has a lot of head injuries, but it has a lot less. And the reason it has a lot less is because they're not wearing any equipment. And a lot of people have said that because football players are wearing as much equipment as they are, they feel invincible. They feel invincible, and they feel that they could throw their bodies, and they feel that they can do all of these things. And to a certain degree, they're right. There's no question the equipment has gone a long way to protecting people and making the individual safer, but it's made the sport more dangerous.
Yeah.
Because these guys are so fast and so strong. I've always said, it's funny, we watch the Olympics and you watch these incredible feats, but you don't really have a sense. Like, somebody runs 9.2 seconds in 100 meters. You're like, wow, that seems really fast. But what I've always said, what they need to do is they need to have an extra lane with just like an average Joe. Right? So here is Jeff Sankoff, who trains pretty regularly. He's a 57-year-old man. He's like, he's a really good triathlete, and he's going to run the 100 meters next to these sprinters. And so when they're all done and they're all celebrating their win, I'll still be like 4 seconds down the track coming as hard as I can to try and finish. Because we don't have a clue what these elite athletes are doing because we only see them against each other. So right. We don't really have a sense. Unless you're like, you know, like my son is a runner, so I have a sense of his times. And when I hear the times of some of these other people, I'm like, wow, right? But most people, they don't have a real clue. They just see these amazing athletes doing these amazing things. I think football is the same. I think a lot of us watch football on the weekends, and we see some of the things they do, and we think to ourselves, well, I could probably do that. I'm a strong person. I'm pretty fast. I don't think we have a clue. I think what we would need to see is we would need to see one of these NFL receivers run next to some average Joe and see how he would turn this person inside out and make the catch or things like that.
They used to have this show Pros versus Joe. I don't know if you've seen that. This was a while
ago. That I never seen. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, they had a Pros versus Joes, and they had, I don't know, you know Michael Irvin? Yeah, Michael Irvin. I think Michael Irvin was on there one time, and yes, that's not close. I mean, these guys are supreme athletes. Couple anecdotes. So, I remember I was in the Denver airport when I used to travel for work, and I'm standing in line waiting to go on the plane, and I'm standing next to this huge, muscled up guy, who happens to be holding a muscle magazine, like a fitness magazine. And I can't even look. I'm like, who is this guy? This guy is so beastly. He's just huge and cut up. And, they start calling the people to board and everything like that, different boarding plane lanes and everything like that. And they call business class, first class, whatever it is. And then I get on. And I walk by and I look down. It's Shannon Sharp. And I'm like, now, how in the heck would I have tackled Shannon Sharp as a defensive back? This guy was humongous. So I'm like, the person who's tackling Shannon Sharp one-on-one has to be just as big and just as strong. So there is no chance in hell that I'm making tackles in the NFL or I'm playing in the NFL. My weight right now is like 5'11", 175. And there's actually guys my size playing in the NFL. But these guys, they're not, you know, the ones making big tackles across the middle. They're playing on the outskirts. I'm like, I would have had to play literally on the edges. Like, as soon as I catch the ball, I'm running out of bounds. Or I would have died getting tackled by somebody who can tackle Shannon Sharp. Secondly, I went to Florida State. I told you I went to Florida State. And the best athletes at the school were football players. Like, they were the best basketball. They were like the best everything, best athletes. And these guys were the strongest, they could jump the highest. Like, they were bred to be football players. And I'm like, the average person doesn't really have, if you've never been in contact with that and seen that up close, you're right. Like, you have no idea what it takes to play football and to endure the violence. These aren't regular guys like me hitting you. Okay, you know, I can hit you. You probably will stand it. Like, these are strong, powerful, fast dudes and making a decision every play to hit each other. And you're right. That's why I don't think the average Joe gets what the impact is on your body. Oh, yeah, I could play football. I'm willing to play football for $100 million. Maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy, I can't remember his name, and I can't remember who he played for, but he was a second or third string NBA basketball player. And he, real tall, center kind of guy. I wish I could remember the whole story. But basically, people used to call him out on Twitter all the time and be like, oh, you suck so bad. I could beat you. And people were always like harassing this guy. Anyways, he retires from the NBA very recently. And he decides, you know what? You guys think you could take me? Let's go.
Oh, are you talking about anybody, Brian Scalabrine?
Is that who it is?
Yeah, red hair.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, that's him. That was awesome. And then he started showing up and actually going one-on-one on all the guys that were hating on him on Twitter, and he would destroy them because even the worst player in the NBA, which he would say, he's like, I'm one of the worst players in the NBA, and I will still destroy you. And he did every single time. It was awesome.
Yeah. Anybody who watched Brian Scalabrine would know not to trash talk him. So there are guys who are in the NBA. I feel like you're in the NBA, and Charles Barkley says this all the time, like, you have to have an NBA skill. Brian Scalabrine wasn't the greatest athlete, but his NBA skill was his ability to score. And I watched him in college. Like, he can score the basketball. So if a regular guy says they could beat Brian Scalabrine, no, you're not, because he can actually score on the NBA level. The problem is he couldn't play any defense and he wasn't athletic to keep up with these other athletes. So I remember that he embarrassed a couple dudes.
I'm going to bring it back to triathlon for just a second, because one of the really interesting things about triathlon is that professionals and amateurs race at the same time on the same course. So we really do get to see the difference, and we really do get to see how we measure up. So I, for example, I'm a very strong age grouper within my age group. Like, I routinely finish in the top five of my age group. Now, I'm an older age group. I'm 55 to 59-year-old male, so I'm going to be way off the pros. But I'm still pretty fast, and I go out there and I'll swim, you know, for 1,900 meters or 1.2 miles. I'll swim about 32 to 33 minutes. The pros are going to swim that in about 20 minutes.
Dang.
And then I will bike the 56-mile course. Again, I'm one of the stronger bikers in my age group, and I'm actually one of the stronger in the whole age group field. I'll finish in the top like 5 or 10%, and I will bike 56 miles in around 2 hours and 20 minutes or so, 2:22, let's say. And the pros will do that in around 2 hours flat. So by the time I get off the bike, they're already half an hour ahead of me. Yeah. And then on the run, I'm a reasonably strong runner. I can run a half marathon in about 135, 136. These guys are running it in 110. So they're going sub 4 hours for a 70.3 race, and I'm going maybe 430, 440.
Wow. No, that. Well, yeah. I wish you're right. I wish there was a way for average people to run against the fastest guy.
It is amazing, because sometimes these courses have loops, right? So you'll be doing loop bikes or like laps of the bike or laps of the run, and the pros will come by and you'll get a real sense of the difference. And
like, they're lapping you.
It and the speed that they move with is amazing. It is one of the sports where we do race at the same time on the same course, and you do get to sort of see how you measure up and you see how you don't measure up. So none of the age groupers have any real illusions that they're anywhere close to the pros in triathlon.
Yeah, I can't imagine you're like, well, maybe I could take this guy on. I'm not going to lie. I think a lot of guys who play basketball, pick up basketball. Like, I can, and that's the confidence of sports. Right? I talked about this on one episode, like the confidence it takes to be an athlete. You kind of have to believe that, though, if you're going to be successful. You have to. You may not truly believe that, but, like, you got to – if you're going to – in basketball, in football, like, in these sports where you're actually playing against somebody, you have to believe, like, yo, I am the best person on this court. Even if there was an NBA player on this court, like, I would beat him. Because if you don't have that mindset, then you're gonna end up losing before the game even starts, right? And that's how the best of the best who are really good at trash talking, like a Michael Jordan – would, you know, before you even get on the court with him, he's already beating you because you're already looking at him like, oh, he's the best player in the world. Like, if you don't believe, like, you're the best basketball player when you step on the court, like, you're probably going to end up losing. So I could see that mindset a little bit, at least in basketball and football. I don't know about triathlete and all that.
I think that you're right. I think that we all kind of, but we also spend so much time as a kid imagining ourselves at that level. I know for me, I would play street hockey outside all the time and you'd score the winning goal for the Stanley Cup. I mean, that's what you did. You just didn't, you know, and I'm sure if you played basketball as a kid, you imagined you were taking that game winning shot in the NBA finals, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So bringing it back to football real quick. So I my belief is, the NFL has hidden and continues to hide the impact of injuries and head injuries on the sport, on the individuals playing the sport. You know, a lot of people, I don't know if you paid attention to this stuff around Colin Kaepernick kneeling and all that, right? A lot of people, you know, said, I'm going to stop watching because Colin Kaepernick is kneeling. And then, you know, there were other folks on the other side who were like, I'm going to stop watching the NFL because Colin Kaepernick got banned and, you know, he needs, until he gets his job back, we're not going to watch anymore. And most of those people continue to watch to this day, right? The NFL slapped the end racism and all these sayings on the field. You know, they continue to have, you know, military stuff and military paraphernalia in the month of November for, you know, whatever the holiday is that's in November. What is that? Veterans Day? And so they celebrated the whole month and all that stuff. So the NFL knows people aren't going to stop watching for those reasons. But I think you make up a demographic that maybe scares them. And that is, as people actually learn more about the health impacts of football, they truly aren't going to watch, right? People lie about other things. I'm not going to watch. These guys make too much money. They're entitled. You're still watching. You're still playing fantasy football. You're still gambling. But I think the people who truly have a shot of hurting the NFL, and that's why they keep a lot of the stuff secret, is the people who are like, man, who start caring about the players and their long-term health.
I don't trust that there's a large enough population of people like me. I think that
really?
I think I'm a very small minority. I just, the average sports fan takes it in as entertainment and isn't really interested in thinking too hard about it. And I don't listen. I'm not here to preach to anybody. I'm not here to tell you you're right or wrong. I made this decision for me. I just felt like morally and ethically, and I am actually an ethicist at the hospital I work with, so I do ethics consults. So if there is an ethical issue about treatment or something like that, they call the ethics team. I'm one of the ethicists. So it's something that I take seriously, and just to me, the ethics and morals of football as a sport don't align with how I see the world. And so I am not okay watching it and not okay taking part in it. But again, I'm not going to tell other people what to do about it. And I certainly understand why my viewpoint is probably a very, very tiny, tiny minority.
Yeah. Can we pivot real quick? You just said something that I find interesting. What's an ethics team? That's,
so every hospital,
is there unethical treatments?
It's not so much that there's unethical treatments, but that every hospital will continuously face ethical questions. So I'll give you an example. A patient who has a devastating stroke and non-survivable. Basically, they are not going to wake up. And so the physicians want very much to stop treatment because they feel it's harming the patient, and the family is not willing to let go. They feel that everything should be done for the patient. And so at that point, the treating team will call the ethics team and say, is it ethical for us to continue treating this patient when it's futile and potentially causing harm to the patient? And so that's where we come in.
Why do they need to ask you? Like, what kind of question is that? Is it ethical? Like, if you know the person is not going to survive, like, why even ask the question?
Because we are in a society where we don't allow physicians to arbitrarily stop treatment. Because if we did that, then you could imagine that would open a whole Pandora's box. So, for example, what if a person didn't have a devastating stroke? Maybe they had Down syndrome. And maybe there was a physician who doesn't think that people with Down syndrome have a high quality of life, and therefore they don't want to continue treatment. So we as physicians practice with a overarching set of ethical principles that guide our practice. And occasionally we run into these cases that put us into what's called moral distress, where we are being forced to do something that is kind of against our own ethics and against our professional ethics. And that would be one case where we're being asked to provide treatment that is futile and potentially harmful.
Gotcha. Okay. I was making the assumption that, well, if this person's already been determined that they're not going to survive, why do you need ethics? No, that's I didn't know that. All hospitals have that?
They're supposed to. Smaller hospitals may not have an ethics team. They may use outside resources. But I work at a major inner city hospital, so we have a pretty large ethics team.
So you guys are like trauma one unit type of thing?
Yeah.
Those are crazy hospitals.
Yeah, it can be.
All right. before we wrap up, so we talked a little bit about the money-making machine that is the supplement industry. And you had some interesting thoughts around what works and what doesn't work in terms of, so guys are always looking to boost their energy, you know, have more energy for workouts, whatever it is that they work out in, or endurance, right? So we talked about some of the things that work and some of the things that don't work. And you made some recommendations that I wanted you to share with the audience based on your experience. What do you find that actually works and some of the things that actually don't work? So I did a quick Google search on, you know, what triathletes, like supplements that they recommend for triathletes. And the first thing on there was like everything I looked up. The first thing was like creatine.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I
always thought creatine was like for weightlifting and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I do a podcast, as you mentioned early on, I do the TriDoc podcast. And on that podcast, every 2 weeks, we answer a medical question. And that medical question, I would say probably 50 or 60% of the time involves some kind of supplement or some kind of product that's out there. And there products run the gamut, but it's just amazing how many supplements there are. And I understand. We talked earlier about how time poor we all are and how we're all trying to do our best and get our training done and get the most out of our training. And there is this belief that if I can take a pill, that's going to give me an edge over my competition because I'll be able to train smarter, train harder, and get more benefits out of my training because of this little pill. The reality is that there are no shortcuts, that the only way to get better is really to invest in yourself and to train smart and to train hard for sure and to be as consistent as possible. With that said, there are some supplements that have been shown to be beneficial in different kinds of scenarios. So creatine is wildly popular right now. It's getting a lot of press. And there is evidence that shows that creatine is a positive supplement for resistance training. So people who do weight training, creatine helps build muscle mass, it helps with recovery, and it helps with strength. There's no question. Creatine is beneficial in that scenario. There's also no question that creatine does absolutely nothing for endurance athletes. And yet, I know many, many endurance athletes that are gobbling up creatine as much as they can. So, but that's just one more example.
Every single site I went to said creatine. I was like, okay, well, it must work. It must do something.
Yeah. Well, nobody reads the papers, apparently. But I've read the papers, and the papers are very clear that creatine does not help with the measures that are important for endurance athletes. So you're not going to run faster. You're not going to bike faster. You're not going to swim better. And you're not going to recover any better. You are going to put on weight, and that's not something that most endurance athletes want.
Okay. Good. Creatine, if you're trying to be a bodybuilder, otherwise, stay away. Not related to any Ironman website, but I do have a friend of mine who says he takes deer antler spray. And deer antler spray became famous because Ray Lewis, you know Ray Lewis, former linebacker.
Yeah.
Infamously took deer antler spray. And it, I guess it helped them recover from like a torn tricep or bicep or something like that. Mid-season, and he was able to make it back for the playoffs, and they ended up winning the Super Bowl that year. What are your thoughts on deer antler spray?
So I want to be cautious and just first of all say that a lot of these things have a placebo effect. And if somebody thinks that something is working for them, then I'm not here to tell you that it's not. So if you have a friend that's using deer antler spray and they swear up and down that it's helping them in some way, great. I'm happy for them. The science is pretty clear that deer antler spray doesn't do anything. So probably not really benefiting. But again, that is across a population that is in a study situation. That doesn't mean that your friend isn't getting a benefit. There are going to be people who don't behave the way the study populations do. And even within those study population, there is going to be a few people that feel like they're getting a benefit. So all I could say is that there's no real good evidence to suggest that deer antler spray does anything for anyone. I imagine it probably doesn't help the deer either.
All right, so here's one. If you're watching a football game, basketball game, there is not going to be a single commercial break where you're not going to get an ad for testosterone pills. It boosts energy in and out of the bedroom. That stuff got to be people who come on, man. For it to be like so commercialized, it has to have some benefit, does it?
Drug companies are incredibly adept at creating a need for a product they have. So what happened was about two decades ago, it might be three decades ago now, the drug companies figured out how to manufacture testosterone. And they did that because there was a need. There was, I don't remember what drove the development of testosterone. I can't remember what the history was. But for whatever reason, they were able to synthesize testosterone. And it cost them a lot of money to develop that process, and it cost them a lot of money to make testosterone. And so now they've got all this testosterone sitting in vats, and I don't know what else they do with it, and it's just sitting there. And they look at each other, and they go, well, what are we going to do with this stuff? Because the people who we made it for, there's not that many of them, the people who actually need this. The people who have hypogonadism, meaning that their testicles don't produce a normal amount of testosterone and they actually have a problem physiologically. Those people are very small in number, but we can make testosterone hand over fist. So we need to come up with a way to sell this stuff. And so the drug companies invented a disease and they called it low T.
Wow.
And what they did was they managed through slick advertising and through a lot of somewhat unscrupulous and unethical, bring that back, some unethical ways to take what is a normal thing, that as we get older, our testosterone levels normally decline. And they now have convinced people, oh, no, no, no. You have low T. So if you go in and you're in your 40s or 50s and they'll take a blood test and they'll measure your testosterone, what they did is like they know that the normal range of testosterone is here and they just sort of shifted it a little bit so that everybody looks like they're low. And, oh, you're at kind of the low level. And then they ask you, what are your symptoms? Oh, you're tired in the morning. Oh, you can't exercise as much or as well as you used to when you were like 20. And it's like, yeah, that's called getting older.
Duh.
That's what happens. And so they've created this disease that doesn't exist. It's not a disease. It's just called getting older. And everybody wants to feel youthful. And so they're shooting everybody up with testosterone. And it's not okay. Because what's happening is, does it work? Well, it works in some ways. It doesn't work for endurance athletes because testosterone has never been shown to help with any metrics of endurance performance. It helps with building muscle mass. So if you're a weightlifter, again, sure, testosterone is an anabolic hormone, so it's going to help with that. It also is going to cause potential heart disease and stroke. We know that. The longer you take exogenous testosterone, the higher risk you have for those two problems.
What was that word? Exogenous?
Exogenous.
What does that
mean? So it means testosterone that's not made by you. You're taking it it's from the outside.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't even know that. So I don't think they have like the prescription medications, they have to have like the blurbs at the bottom of the screen that says, you know, you might, you know, suffer this and die from this, right? I don't think they have those.
Well, because the stuff that I don't know what they're showing, these supplement things, but I will say that most of the supplements are not actual testosterone. What they're selling in the supplements is what they're saying is, oh, take this and it will boost your testosterone, which is complete rubbish. No, it's garbage. No, it does not work. It doesn't do that. Oh. But they're saying that. And because they're saying that, they don't have to give any of the potential risks or any of that. And they're not drugs. They're not regulated by the FDA because they're available over the counter. And so they're not saying that you're taking, because you can't take testosterone orally. Testosterone is either an injection or it's a cream that you put on your skin that gets absorbed. Anything you're taking by mouth is going to be one of these
boosters,
you know, testosterone boosters, which don't do anything.
You know, my primary care physician retired from his practice to go do hormone therapy.
Because there's a ethical? Booming business. Is it ethical? I mean, there's a desire for it and there's a market for it. And we are in a free market society. I mean, I wouldn't do it because that wouldn't fit with my morals. But there are a lot of people that don't have a problem. Listen, I wouldn't do Botox either.
Yeah. So you're saying losing testosterone decreasing is natural. Is there
completely
a natural
normal
way to increase testosterone? So it just is what it is.
It is what it is. And look, I'm 57. I'm performing athletically almost as well as I was when I was 47. And honestly, I weigh less. I'm healthier all in all. I mean, you can do it. It just requires more work and you have to train smarter. Like I have to be careful about, I can't have back-to-back really hard days the way I used to, but I can still do the hard days. I just need to be smarter about how I do it. I need to give myself a little more recovery time. I need to eat better. I have to eat a lot more protein. I have to make sure I'm doing strength work. There are ways to adapt as you get older to make sure that you stay healthy and that you stay youthful. But you're never going to reverse the clock. It's just not going to happen. And all of these agents that are promising things, it's illusory. It's just not happening. I know. I'm sorry.
My audience hears that.
I'm sorry to burst the bubble.
Sad to hear. There's no.
But these companies are very unethical because they're basically promising things they know they can't deliver, but they're promising things that people are desperate for, and so people run out and spend a lot of money on it.
And you can't sue them, right? Because
nope, they're not drugs. They're supplements.
Supplements. Wow.
And so, you know, you asked me before about things that work and things that don't work. Well, I've had 156 episodes, and in that 156 episodes, we've reviewed probably 150 things that don't work. But we have come across a few things that do work. And you know what? Almost all of them are natural products.
Let me say real quick. Some athletes, right, track stars, got busted for taking, like, HGH and all these different things, right? Like, what is in those things, illegal or not, that works versus testosterone or boosters or the stuff that doesn't work?
Well, testosterone, as I said, it does work in some cases. Testosterone doesn't work for endurance athlete. I'm an endurance athlete. I do triathlon, so testosterone is not of particular interest to me. HGH is a different story. Human growth hormone does actually improve one of the measures of endurance, which is something we call VO2 max, which is basically the ability of your cells to metabolize oxygen in order to produce energy. And with HGH, your VO2 max can be increased, and therefore so too can your ability to perform in endurance sport. HGH has also been shown to build muscle mass and therefore help with strength. So that's why baseball players used to take it, especially older pitchers, because it would help them retain their fastball for longer. The other one that is common amongst endurance athletes, and this is more common in cross-country skiers and cyclists, is EPO. EPO is a hormone that's naturally made by the kidney, and it basically stimulates the production of red blood cells in your bone marrow. Well, if you take exogenous EPO, if you basically stick a needle in your arm that has EPO in it, you can make your body produce more red blood cells. And the way that helps is it increases your oxygen carrying capacity. So you're able to carry more oxygen to your blood, to your muscles that are working, and provide your muscles with a higher amount of oxygen and therefore be able to perform at a higher capacity in endurance sport. It doesn't help so much with strength.
Okay. So none of the fake stuff works. All right. That's what we get. What actually works? You said you found a few things that do work. What actually works, and that's not going to kill us?
Sleep. Boring. Okay. Super boring. You know what, though? You get lots of commercials about sleep. If I see that stupid MyPillow guy one more time, right? But the reality is that sleep is a huge industry. There are a million different...
How much sleep should we get? Because, man, I'm going to tell you, I feel like I get six or less every night.
8 hours.
So the recommendation in this case is actually true. 8 hours.
Yep. And I'm not gonna lie. When you're my age, it's really hard to sleep 8 hours. I do shift work, and it's hard for me to get 8 hours. But I'll tell you, when I get 8 hours, I feel amazing. So 8 hours is what people should be striving for, and the way to do it, go to sleep early. People who go to sleep early will get more sleep. No question. And
so
we're not like
that. You can't watch the football game, man. You're killing us.
More reasons not to watch.
You can't watch the football game. You can't watch the basketball game. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes, especially during the NBA playoffs where they have these West Coast games and like, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30. It's like I'm trying to stay up to watch the fourth quarter of a playoff.
Well, there's another thing that works that's the opposite of sleep, and that's caffeine. Caffeine has been shown definitively to improve performance by around 5%.
Like any kind of caffeine, like Folgers caffeine or...
Any kind of caffeine, although there are health benefits of coffee. So getting your caffeine from coffee is probably better than getting it from like energy drinks or Coke or whatever.
Like Red Bull.
Exactly. Coffee, actually, there are all kinds of chemicals in coffee that are antioxidants and that have been shown to be quite healthful. So drinking coffee is probably the best way to get your caffeine.
Okay. I saw on the websites they were mentioning beets.
So beetroot juice, yep.
Beetroot juice. So not a supplement with beets, but like... Beetroot juice.
Yeah, you don't want to take supplements. There are supplements of beetroot powders and things like that. As long as you're mixing it to make a liquid that you drink, it's fine. And the reason for that is because what beetroot juice is it's a precursor of nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a vasodilator. It causes your blood vessels to dilate. And so what that does is once you absorb nitric oxide into your blood from the beetroot juice, it travels all through your blood, and when it gets to the smallest blood vessels, it causes them to dilate and allow more blood flow to your muscles, so allows more oxygen delivery to your muscles. So beetroot juice has been shown to be quite helpful with both endurance sport but also with strength sport. There are a couple of issues with beetroot juice. Number one, it has to be taken orally. It can't be in pill form. It can't be in some form that bypasses the mouth. The reason for that is because it's first digestion, it's first activated by the enzymes that are in your mouth. So it's very important, don't brush your teeth before you take beetroot juice, because the bacteria that live in your mouth, that live on your teeth, are part of the process of metabolizing the beetroot juice. So they have shown that if you brush your teeth before you take beetroot juice, the beetroot juice is not as effective. The other thing about beetroot juice is it doesn't last very long. So for people like me who are competing in a triathlon that takes many, many hours, beetroot juice is not particularly helpful because its effects wear off after about 45 to 60 minutes. It's done. You're not going to get any more benefit. And the third thing about beetroot juice is that there seems to be much more impact for men than for women. For whatever reason, women don't seem to benefit nearly as much from beetroot juice as men do. However, beetroot juice is super, super healthful and makes you healthy, so I have no problems recommending it across the board for anybody who wants to take it. The one thing I will warn you about, if you do try beetroot juice, is it makes you poop in a way that's very alarming. So be prepared for that. It may look like you're bleeding out. You're not. It's just the beets.
So I eat beets pretty regularly. The beets, though. So you're saying beetroot
they can't
juice
be cooked.
Is that the leafy
no,
part?
No, the leafy part is not the good part. It's the beets itself, and they can't be stewed beets. They have to be like kind of raw beets.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Stewing the beets breaks down the nitrates.
So damn. So what am I eating then? Just purple?
Well, you're still eating very good. I mean, listen, they're very good for you, beets. So they're chock full of vitamins. Your mom was right to get you on beets.
Okay, no, I like beets. I make beets, eat it by itself. I eat it beet and potato salad.
If you have raw beets, you just throw them into the blender as part of a smoothie, and that's how you can get some beetroot juice there.
Cool. What else has been shown to be beneficial?
Tart cherry juice. Tart cherry juice is very beneficial, especially for people who are exerting themselves, be it through endurance sport or through resistance exercise like strength. Tart cherry juice is full of polyphenols, which are antioxidant chemicals and free radical scavengers, and do a great job of helping clear out all of the evil humors that build up in your muscles when you do a really hard workout. And tart cherry juice has been shown to improve recovery and improve performance on the subsequent day. So tart cherry juice, really, really beneficial. The other thing in tart cherry juice is melatonin. Very, very concentrated source of melatonin, and it has been shown to help with sleep. So if you take some tart cherry juice at night before you go to bed, sleep has been shown to be improved. So there's another way to improve your sleep.
Tart cherry juice.
Another one is spirulina. You'll notice a theme here. These are all natural, plant-based things,
yeah.
And they have science to show that they're beneficial. So spirulina is a blue-green algae. It was once called a superfood because it's so easy to cultivate, and it's got so many good things in it. Very high in B vitamins, a high amount of iron. It's got all kinds of different micronutrients in it. So it's a really, really good supplement food. And it has been shown also to benefit endurance sport.
Spirulina, I've never heard of that, to be honest with you. Where do you get that?
You could buy it at organic food stores. You can get it on Amazon. Comes in the jug.
They don't sell those as a supplement, do they?
You can get it in capsule form, but honestly, it's really cheap if you just buy it as a powder. And you just throw the powder into a smoothie.
Okay, so we got beetroot juice, we got tart cherry juice, we got spirulina.
Caffeine and sleep.
Top five.
And then the other one that I would throw in here, which I think is important, is your microbiome. So you've probably heard a little bit about the microbiome, your gut, right? And some of the most fascinating research that I have reviewed for the podcast had to do with how exercise impacts your microbiome and how your microbiome impacts your ability to do exercise. It turns out that if your microbiome is healthy, you will perform better across the board, no matter what kind of exercise you do. And so keeping your microbiome healthy is super, super important. So how do we keep it healthy? Well, we decrease the amount of fats that we eat, because eating fats causes a selection of bacteria that are not good for our microbiome. So low fat intake. The other thing is eating foods that supplement our microbiome, eating fermented foods. So yogurts with active culture, cottage cheese, pickles, kimchi, kombucha, all those foods have healthy bacteria that can augment your microbiome and make your microbiome healthier. And if you're like me, I love most of those foods and it's very easy for me to incorporate them into my diet. We know that antibiotics can be helpful, but if you are the kind of person who goes to your doctor and always asks for antibiotics and your doctor is giving them to you when they are not particularly useful, you will wipe out your microbiome. You will absolutely decimate your microbiome, and it takes weeks to months for your microbiome to recover. So antibiotics are a good thing if you need them, but what you really want to ask your doctor is not, don't go to your doctor and say, I want a prescription. Go to your doctor and say, do I really need antibiotics? And if I really need them, I'll take them. But if I don't need them, I don't want.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know if I think I told you this, that my wife's a registered dietitian and she specializes in gut health and anti-inflammatory therapy. So she preaches that stuff. That's like right up her wheelhouse. So
she and I would see eye to eye.
Uh-huh.
She and I would see eye to eye.
Yeah, 100%. What you just said here is what she preaches all the time. And I need to get back her on the podcast so she could talk about that, the impacts of exercising and on the microbiome. So really, really good list. And to my audience, I hope you guys are listening. Because I think as, you know, when we were growing up and even now, right, a lot of guys, man, they're taking a ton of stuff. And maybe it's just placebo effect. Maybe it works a little bit. Who knows? But you heard it here from a doctor who specializes in this stuff. Maybe you guys can save some money and not blow your life savings on supplements trying to get better shape. No, really, really good list. I appreciate that, Jeff. Any last thoughts from you for my audience? And where can they find you online?
Yeah. Well, my last thoughts are, I just want to bring it back to triathlon just for a second and say, if you are somebody who has ever thought about doing a multi-sport event, just go out and try it. There are all kinds of starter triathlons, try kind of events where you can just dip your toe in the water, quite literally, and get used to the idea of doing a swim, bike, run event. And I promise you, it is so different than running events or even biking events. It is a great community of people. It is a really supportive and enthusiastic crowd, and it's very empowering to finish an event where you do three things instead of just one. It's really quite an amazing feeling. If you have any questions, anybody out there, please don't hesitate to reach out. I'd love to chat with you about it. And in terms of where to reach me, I am on Instagram as try.coaching. That's all one word. I guess that's really the best place. I am on Facebook, but Facebook is kind of hard to find me because I can't be on there with my own name. That's a whole other story. But you can find me as try.coaching on Instagram as well. And yeah, those are probably the best places to find me.
The man of mystery. Do you do virtual coaching?
I do. I coach athletes mostly remotely. I've had athletes locally, but right now I'm carrying about 15 or 16 athletes and they're all over the country.
Okay. And if I were to want to get started with triathlete, what do I just buy a bike and start riding?
The bike is the big purchase, no question. And yeah, it's just a matter of getting in the pool, swimming, and you have to find the balance. I mean, that's where I come in as a coach, is helping people construct a training program. But there are a lot of different programs you can find online that just can get you started on how to balance the swimming, the biking, and the running.
Cool. Excellent. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on, Jeff. As I'm trying to expand my knowledge base, my horizons, and my audience as well, hoping you guys learn something from this episode, whether it's about triathletes and about hockey and football injuries, whatever it is. Hoping you guys, you know, got something from it. I know I did. So I appreciate you for coming on. Anytime you want to come back on, talk sports, talk health and mental health, whatever it is, I'll be glad to have you on.
Thanks so much, Mike. It was really a pleasure.
All right. Excellent. All right, guys. Thanks for watching, listening as always. I will catch you guys next time. I'm Mike with Jeff here, Sports and the Real Shit. You guys be good.
I'm going straight to the top. Just put the sack on the clock. I am Ray Allen's a shot. I'm going straight to the top.